I'm Steve Chaney. I'm the CEO of the American Security Project. And welcome to today's talk. We're going to talk about the nexus between climate change and national security. But let me start off with a little ground rules, if you will. I'm a Marine, so I like to start things on time, and I like to finish things on time. So we're going to go from 12:30 to 1:30. And what I'd like to do is talk for myself 10 to 12 minutes, give or take. I'm going to introduce General Adams, let him have a little talk, then I'll close a little bit. This all should take between the two of us about 30 minutes, I would guess. And then we can have it up into a conversation and a Q&A. And I think this is a tidy enough group, and the room is at least small enough at the table that we'll be able to do it without a roving microphone. For those not familiar with the American Security Project, we are a small 501c3 that was created in 2005 by Senators Kerry, Hart, Hagel, and Rudman. A couple of names you might know. And their thought was at the time that there were topical issues that were brought up in the 2004 campaign, climate change being predominant among them, that when they were talked about, they automatically got painted, in most cases, as left-wing liberal tree hugger. And the facts never got discussed. And so they thought that if we could look at that subject along with nuclear security, energy security, terrorism, asymmetric operations, and American competitiveness, from a factual perspective, and then add a national security point of view to that, maybe we could convince others that there really is something to climate change. So they put a board together that had an equal number at that time of Republicans and Democrats. They were all former senators except for one, which was Senator Kerry, who was active. Then we had a number of businessmen and women that helped get the organization going. And then we added 8 flag officers. And flag officers at that time, it was 3 and 4-star generals and admirals across all the services. They were all retired, and they would lend a national security perspective to each one of those issues. So we've been on this particular issue for quite a while, and it's been important, and we're not going to let it die. Now, I happen to know Secretary Kerry very well. He dropped from our board when he became the secretary, so we have to distance ourselves from him and Secretary Hagel as well. But I can tell you he feels very passionately about climate change. You might have seen his speech in Indonesia last week. And a quote from that was, "Climate change is perhaps the world's most fearsome weapon of mass destruction." And for those of us who were back inside the Beltway, all the pundits had a holiday, and Newt Gingrich was on Crossfire. I saw him last week with Joe Cirincione, who's a friend of mine. And it was interesting because Crossfire did do one thing right. They ran a video of Newt and then Senator Kerry talking climate change, where Newt was in strong support of the science that supported climate change. Of course, his tone has changed dramatically since, but I think they had him on that one in particular. And then over the weekend, another one of my favorites, Charles Krauthammer, had an editorial in the Washington Post, and he had a couple of things in there I just found rather astonishing. Well, the first one, of course, he says, "How in the world can you think that climate change is any worse than a nuclear weapon?" And I could talk about that for a while, but I think the intent here is that climate change is going to last a long, long time, and now that we have started it by dumping CO2 into our atmosphere, we're going to have a long, long time to reverse that process. What we'd like to see at the American Security Project, of course, is that we do away with nuclear weapons. It's probably not going to happen anytime soon either, but we think the chances of a nuclear holocaust are rather slim. So I think, in the words of Secretary Kerry, climate change is more of a threat. Of course, Krauthammer did add to that by saying, "Didn't you look at the science behind mammographies? And that was all proven wrong, so the same thing can happen on climate change." And I said, boy, there's a wrong place to go on that one. And it's just part of the lunacy that goes on inside the Beltway. So we've been asked by a number of organizations to take our little roadshow outside the Beltway. A couple in particular are very interested in what we do, and they like our work. And we've started a round that we're going to hit 10 different cities over the next year and a half plus, going to not your normal places. And I say not your normal. We're not in D.C. We're not going to New York, Boston, Philadelphia, Baltimore, none of the Northeast Corridor type cities. We did go to Pittsburgh 2 weeks ago, and if you're familiar with what's going on in Pittsburgh, they're in the middle of coal country. The fracking is rampant there. I won't say it's into the den of the enemy, so to speak, but it was a very interesting 2 days. And these events that we're sponsoring are 2-day events. We hit a number of universities, hit radio stations. And the intent behind it is to fan the flame on climate change and explain, one, a little bit about the science, and secondly, that indeed is a big, big threat. And I come from a military perspective on it. I did 31 years as a Marine and retired in 2001. And a third of my career plus was in the Pacific area, either California or in Japan. So I've got to focus that way. And I'll talk about General Adams here in a little bit. His focus was all over the world, literally, but a lot of it was in Europe. So he comes from perhaps a little bit different perspective on it. But we in the military have been the ones that have always had to respond to a particular crisis or contingency. When it all happens, like Hurricane or Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines, the Navy and Marines in that case ended up responding with about 13,000 of their people. Or in the case of Superstorm Sandy, that was a joint operation. Army, Navy, Marine, Air Force, Coast Guard, Guard, Air Guard, National Guard all had to respond to that particular event. And you might think, well, isn't that your job? It is. But guys in the military are pretty expert at planning. You go to any what we call combatant commander, they have what's called the J5 plans, and they do planning as a profession, and they're, generally speaking, pretty good about it. And I will tell you, every COCOM has written somewhere in their security strategy something about climate change, because ultimately climate change is causing a lot of the instability that we have today in the world. Obviously, we believe it's real and it's a big challenge. The word I like to use is it's a threat multiplier, an accelerant of instability. It's going to cause food shortages, water shortages, energy shortages, migration, and we will mention specific cases of all of these. And as I mentioned, the military is going to be challenged to respond, and particularly when you look and see what's going on in the Arctic these days. The Arctic's melting and going to melt. And of course, the hot thing or the cold thing back where I am is polar vortex. The day I left Saturday to go down to LA and come out here, I had to chip a half inch of ice off my car, and we're getting another 5 inches today of snow. So you would think, oh, there's no climate change, and I can refute every one of those arguments, and probably will here in just a little bit. I personally have been the victim of it several times. I took over a prep school in Deep South Texas in 2006. When I went down there, they had verdant fields in the Rio Grande Valley. It was green as far as you could see. They were actually growing rice. It was a big crop down there, cotton, soybeans, corn, a huge cattle industry. When I left in 2011, it was all gone. I mean, it is all gone. You fly into Brownsville or Harlingen or McAllen, Texas, you will see brown forever. It doesn't matter what time of year. They're in the worst severe drought that they've ever had in their history. Just as another small vignette, in 1999, I took over the recruit depot at Parris Island, South Carolina. And when I took over that particular base, my predecessor said, you know what your biggest problem is going to be? And I said, no, what's that? He said, it's going to be hurricanes. 60 days later, Hurricane Floyd, a Category 5 hurricane, took dead aim on Parris Island. Parris Island is about 12 feet above mean sea level. It was supposed to be 26-foot storm surge, so do the math. I had 10,000 people on that base that we had to evacuate 150 miles and do it in 48 hours. Now, we good military guys, we had planned for that, and we knew how to do it, and we did it. Fortunately, Floyd did not devastate the base, but Floyd did go to North Carolina. And some might not know this, but it cut Route 95, and Route 95, which is your main road route north and south on the East Coast, was cut for about 10 days because of the flooding it caused in North Carolina. Those types of events are going to be far more common than you would ever believe, and climate change is a contributor to that. And one last kind of personal story, our current chairman of the board at the American Security Project is Gary Hart, which I'm sure many of you know. And Gary really is a great guy. He resides in the Rockies just to the west of Denver. We were having a board meeting last August. He called me and said, I can't make the meeting. My house is about to burn down. Where they had huge forest fires outside of Denver. It had never been close to his house before. Fortunately, it did not burn down. He did make the meeting. He went back home. A month later, he called me. You won't believe this. My next door neighbor's house is just washed away. Tremendous flooding in the Rockies, and you may recall that particular evolution. And I know you're no stranger here to drought or what's going on in the wildfires, and I've got some statistics that I'm going to talk about after John gets up and speak. You know, it's indisputable that the earth is warming. It's just indisputable. And I hear the pundits all the time, and I've got some right-wing buddies of mine who hit me up on it every day. The earth's temperature went up 1.4 degrees over the last century. The last decade, 2000-2010, was the warmest decade in history, or on record, I should say. The three decades prior were the three warmest prior to that. So how can you deny that we're not warming up? And of course, I can tell you why. It's CO2 going into the atmosphere. The science that links carbon emissions to temperature is indeed definitive. We're causing it. And CO2 in the atmosphere has increased 40% since the Industrial Revolution. It's caused, obviously, by the burning of fossil fuels. Without this human influence, when you look at the science, our temperature would have actually gone down. But instead, it's going up, and we're causing it. The arguments that you hear from a lot of these pundits, and I mentioned Gingrich and Krauthammer, I hate to pick on those two, but there are others, obviously. Their arguments are not scientific. In our opinion, they're political, and they're using it for political reasons. 97% of the climate scientists are all in total agreement that man is causing the climate to change and the climate is getting hotter. So you might ask, why does the military care about this? And I mentioned earlier that, hey, we're in the military ended up responding to it almost every time in one way, shape, or form. So I've got a gentleman here who's just got such an incredible background, John, and I won't embarrass you with reading your entire biography, but a very unique Army officer. He was an aviator, flew helicopters, but he was also what we call a foreign area officer, and he served in such incredible assignments as in the U.S. embassies in Belgium, Rwanda, Croatia, and South Korea. So he's literally been around the world. And he's rather unique in another couple of ways. I know that you're fluent in French, Dutch, German, and Croatian. He has 3 master's degrees. He's about to get his doctorate from the University of Arizona. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to General John Adams. John, it's all yours.
Thanks, Steve. I come at this issue of climate change from a military background, just as General Cheney does. My first challenge is to figure out how to use this mic here. Can you hear me? Great. The military must be ready. The military cannot afford to wait. Our military cannot afford to wait until we have certainty in order to prepare for the next battle. Now, that's true whether you're talking about a potential foe, or it's true whether you're talking about climate change. And let me give you an example. As we all remember, in 1989, the wall came down, and the Soviet Union, over the course of the next couple of years, disintegrated. And all of us in the Army at the time, and I was a strategic planner for an infantry division stationed in Europe, all of us in the Army at the time started to adapt to this new reality of instability in Central and Eastern Europe, to East Germany becoming part of Germany, to the Soviet republics breaking away. And one of the ways we adapted was to, instead of training and exercising to fight the Soviet Union, we started to train and exercise to confront potential instability in this Eastern Central Europe and in the former Soviet republics. Well, that was a good thing. It still took us 3 years. I remember in 1992, in an exercise, our exercise planners had constructed a scenario for us to fight the 56th Guards Tank Army of the Soviet Union. And I remember talking to my colleagues in the division staff saying, what are we doing? Why are we practicing for this? We should be practicing for East Germany and instability there, and what we might do if that affected our military operations. So my point is this: the military, our military, must be ready, and we've got to be realistic. And I believe the science. I'm not looking at the science and being a skeptic about what I see. Although I think a skeptical approach to science is not a bad thing, but it has also been conclusively demonstrated that the science is correct. But whether we believe the science or not, my point is this: the effects of climate change on the military are indisputable. And there are 2 major effects for us in the military, in the United States military, that we need to deal with. One is climate change produces and shapes the operational environment within which we have to operate. We have got to adapt ourselves to the effects of climate change, or we will not be ready. The other effect, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. I want to give some specific examples of the way the operational environment is being shaped. The other effect is on the military infrastructure, installations, and the equipment that we have throughout the world. And climate has an effect on that. And it's having an effect that we need to deal with. So there's really two primary aspects of why the military cares about climate change. One is because it shapes the operational environment, and two is because it shapes the infrastructure and the facilities and the training centers that we have to stay ready. So we've got to remember that. The military doesn't have time and doesn't have the option to not prepare for the challenges that they have. And let's take one challenge in particular. Let's look at the warming of the Arctic and the melting of the ice. Challenge. Also an opportunity. This has not happened before. When the first explorers from Europe came to the Western Hemisphere, Henry Hudson was looking for a way to go through the northern ice cap, and he didn't find it. He found a lot of other things, and our brothers and sisters to the north in Canada can be grateful for the fact that he found so much of Canada. But he was looking for a way to go to the other around the world through the north. If he were living today, he could find that way. And so it presents opportunities for trade that we haven't had before. But think about the effect and the challenge that has for the United States military. We don't expect conflict, per se, in the Arctic, although we should prepare for that. That doesn't appear at this point to be the most likely result, but it certainly produces the need for us to deal with this new open sea that we didn't have before. And it's a shared responsibility that we have with our allies to deal with that. So challenges and opportunities. And that is just the beginning of the real issues that we're talking about with climate change. The change in climate changes the conditions under which the American military operates. That's really the bottom line. As General Cheney said, it's an accelerant of instability. And when you have geopolitical instability, which country in the world is the most likely to pick up the burden or opportunity to deal with that instability? Probably among the first is, if not the first, the United States of America. And among the first, if not the first, citizens of the United States of America will be wearing uniforms and sailing in ships or flying military aircraft, or will be land forces that need to land to take care of issues that are resulting from instability caused by climate change, like in the Philippines just a month or so ago. And that's not the first time, nor will it be the last time, that extreme weather in other parts of the world are going to require, and I say require because it really isn't something we cannot do, are going to require the United States to step in and do what we can to try to alleviate human suffering. This is something that we should do to help others in the world that have this kind of suffering. So really, when it comes to planning, we have to prepare for the worst, plan for the most likely, and we really hope we over-prepare. Now, make no mistake, climate change is not going to just affect the American military, it's going to affect the American homeland as well. And this is another mission of the United States military, and that's to be prepared to provide support to civil authorities in the case of natural disasters. And that happens frequently, as we know. Happens here in California pretty frequently, where some part of the United States military, could be active duty, could be guard or reserve, is mobilized to alleviate the suffering produced by wildfires, for example. It can be a matter of climate instability producing drought. And there are some parts of the world that are particularly susceptible to that. And what does drought cause? I mean, it's a knock-on effect of a number of things that can happen. Drought can cause food shortages, which can cause migration, which can cause in its own, I mean, it can very well lead to conflict between populations that traditionally have not gotten along or don't know each other very well. And in some parts of the world, that happens more often than not. So we talk about the accelerant of instability and geopolitical instability. Climate change certainly produces that. I spent a lot of time in Europe during my military career, and Europe certainly has its concerns, and it is affected by climate change. And there are many countries of the world, especially along the coasts, that have really serious plans and have done a lot of work to ensure that their coastline will not be degraded from rising seawater. The Netherlands comes to mind. And there, even as hard as the Netherlands has worked to reclaim much of its, I think 35% of the Netherlands is actually reclaimed from the sea. But the Netherlands has done a tremendous amount of work to prepare for what they know is going to happen. The sea is going to rise, and they've got to be prepared for that. And they're serious about that. So my point is this. The Netherlands, because it's one of the richest economies in the world and one of the highest science and technology beds in the world, can do that. But Bangladesh cannot. So we may have the same climate change effects, rising seawater, where and the people in Europe, because of their science and technology and wealth, are able to deal with it. But the real effects are going to be relative to whether the country is able to prepare for climate change. So we're likely to see, as we already have, we're likely to see much greater effects from climate change in developing parts of the world than in the developed parts of the world like Europe and the United States. And it's easy for us, and I actually live on the Gulf Coast of Florida, so I get to see the effects of climate change, from July till November. And we have extreme weather there, as you know, but it's getting more and more extreme over time, and it's certainly clear to my neighbors. They've seen the extreme effects of weather, and they're seeing more and more of it. So we have it in the United States, but the real effects, the real accelerant of instability is going to be in the developing world, and that's where the military, we in the United States military, need to be prepared for that, for a wide range of missions to deal with this instability. But some of the hot zones that I think we need to keep in mind when we talk about regional instability are, first of all, the Middle East. Climate change is expected to make parched conditions, drought-ridden conditions in the Middle East worse over time. We've already seen problems in many countries of the Middle East because they're water-starved. We already know that fights over water, disputes, international disputes over water they're not hidden, they're actually in the forefront of several Middle Eastern states' foreign policy because their water comes from other countries with whom they don't share the same interests. And if you're talking about potential conflict or you're talking about the engendering of diplomatic disputes leading eventually to military disputes, the fact that the Tigris and the Euphrates begin in Turkey and flow to Iraq and flow to other states in the Middle East is, if nothing else, a huge risk of instability. And we know that the potential for conflict between countries that share this water resource and may not see things the same way in other cases is just that much higher. So we've got to be prepared for that sort of instability. We know that it's tough to justify spending on water issues when you've got a war going on. Ongoing conflict, for example, in Syria and Iraq, for example, they really have pushed down the priority of dealing with the water issues. But it's a vicious cycle. The more they push off the spending on irrigation and water management issues, the worse the civil conflict becomes. One of the things that certainly not the reason why we have the conflict in Syria right now, but one of the things that's contributed to the conflict in Syria is the drought that took place in Syria in the early 2000s. And many people from the rural areas of Syria moved to the cities. And under the Assad regime, which is, I can only condemn it. The real reason why there's conflict in Syria is because Assad kills civilians. But climate change produced at least one of the accelerant effects, causing people to move to the cities where there are no jobs, where there's squalor, where people are, where there's a lot of unrest. And this is the kind of dynamic that we need to get out in front of and prepare for. The same thing is true in Egypt, where difficulties with water management have led to instability there. And I'm not going to talk about the politics of Egypt today, but I think it's something that we should remember. We've got to deal with instability, and climate change produces that. So again, it's shaping the operational environment for the United States in our strategy. Let's look at Africa for a moment, specifically sub-Saharan Africa. Extreme weather and drought is a common thing in much of sub-Saharan Africa. And this produces other problems, whether they lead to armed conflict. They certainly lead to migration. They lead to dislocation of entire populations. We've seen the country of Sudan break in two for, I'm not going to criticize the reasons why they broke in two, but one of the problems that was created was the pressures of climate change reducing or producing massive instability in the population, mass dislocation, food shortages, starvation, and ultimately conflict among ethnic groups in the Sudan. The unrest is really inflamed when the government is unable, doesn't have the governance structures in place to deal with the problems created by climate change. So what does the military do? How does the military react to climate change? First of all, when the climate change produces these new operational environments, the way the military reacts is, as I said before, we have to be realistic, we have to look at the operational environment, and then we have to plan for it. And the solution is, like every other potential threat, we have to manage the risk. We have to know, and business does this too, of course. This is the core of any business evaluation, managing risk. Hard to do. You can't wait till you have 100% certainty, as I said before. But you've got to start managing the risk based on the facts on the ground. And the bottom line in terms of the operational environment for the military is, as we manage the risk, we've got to make sure that we do things to mitigate the risk. And that's where the military is doing something. And I have to say, my service, the Army, is certainly doing its part in trying to manage the risk, from everything from producing less power to there's a program called Net Zero that in the Army, the goal is by 2020 that every Army installation will not have wasted energy. And they're on the way. There's a long way to go, but they're on the way to doing that. Each of the other services has its own program for energy conservation. Each of the services has a program to allow the military forces from that service to operate in this different kind of environment. So it's prudent action to manage the risk, to mitigate the risk. That's what the military has to do. I want to quote Secretary of Defense Hagel for just a moment, because I think he really gets it and understands from a military perspective what the problem is and how to deal with it. Quote, "The challenge of global climate change, while not new to history, is new to the modern world. Climate change does not directly cause conflict, but it can significantly add to the challenges of global instability, hunger, poverty, and conflict. Food and water shortages, pandemic diseases, disputes over refugees and resources, more severe natural disasters, all place additional burdens on economies, societies, and institutions." And he's talking about Typhoon Haiyan in the Philippines. He says this is a reminder of humanitarian disaster brought on by nature. Climatologists warn us of the increased probability of more destructive storms to come. Planning, and this is from Secretary Hagel, planning for climate change and smarter energy investments not only make us a stronger military, they have many additional benefits as well. Saving defense funds, reducing demand, and helping to protect the environment. At the senior levels of the Department of Defense, an acknowledgement that climate change exists is the beginning of being able to manage the risks. There's a couple of other things that I think are worth mentioning in terms of how the military deals with or what the effects on the military's installations and infrastructure are. Rising temperatures, for example, and I think these are interesting for us to think about. Some of them are examples that are kind of down in the weeds, but perhaps it would be useful for all of us to keep these in mind when people say, well, what's the real effect of climate change on the military? Well, this is what it is. For example, rising temperatures produce an increased occurrence of limitations on military vehicle use, on testing equipment, increased energy costs, which takes money away from operational requirements. It is increasing Arctic commerce, and I mentioned before, it's both a challenge and an opportunity. Somebody's got to do it, and somebody's got to protect it. The changes in precipitation patterns, for example, another one that I think it's worth thinking about for just a moment. The effects on the military, reduced land carrying capacity for vehicle maneuvers. Icing on aircraft changes. And I know as a rotor wing aviator, icing happens in all kinds of environments. And it, as you know, the higher up you go in altitude, the more likely you are to have icing even in a warm climate. Climate change, you got to plan for that. Reduced water availability, increased flood control program. Remember, there's a number of things that the changes in precipitation patterns cause the effects on the military. Increasing storm frequency. As a Gulf Coast resident, I'll talk about that for just a second. Personnel safety, prolonged disruption of military operations. Pensacola Naval Air Station 2 weeks ago had its first hard freeze, like down in the teens, for 100 years. I mean, it closed everything. Pensacola Airport was closed for 2 days. If you went to the City Fathers of Pensacola, Florida, and said, buy a snowplow, they'll say, well, we're going to do that. We'll waste our money. Well, those 2 days, people were going, I still don't think they should buy a snowplow. I wouldn't want to pay for that. But the fact that it happens to the military, disruption of military operations from climate change is a real factor. And that happens. That's happening. It's going to happen more and more. Damage to coastal infrastructure. 30% of the United States Navy's coastal infrastructure is affected or will be affected within the next 10 years from rising sea waters. What does that mean? Well, if nothing else, it means that you've got to change the height of the piers because you have to change the height of the ability to get on and off to berth the ships and service the ships. Big expense. Climate change. Changes in ocean temperatures and circulation. Again, it creates all kinds of problems for coastal operations. It creates all kinds of problems for potential instability in other parts of the world that the military has to plan for. I want to conclude with another quote, which I think really sums it up, and it's a it means we it's a really a call to action. And the quote is from Admiral John Nathman, who was the former fleet commander of U.S. Fleet Forces under President George W. Bush, lest you think I'm not going to quote someone. Actually, this is two quotes, both from Republicans, one serving in the Obama administration, one in the Bush administration. Admiral John Nathman said, "There are serious risks to doing nothing about climate change. We can pay now, or we can pay later, a lot more. The U.S. has a unique opportunity to become energy independent, protect our national security, and boost our economy while reducing carbon footprint. We've been a model of success for the rest of the world in the past, and we must lead the way on climate change." And he's absolutely right. It's a fact. The military knows it. They're planning for it, and we must encourage them to continually stay out in front and to plan for climate change. I'd like to pass the mic to General Cheney. He's going to talk a little bit about climate change from the perspective of his service in the Asia-Pacific region.
I see there's no food or water shortage here, so feel free to pony up to what we have left here and eat it, please. I promised to get you out in time to see Miley Cyrus, so I only have a couple hours worth of comments left. As Henry VIII told his six wives, I won't keep it much longer. So I will make the rest of my comments a little short, but I want to tailor them to the Pacific and California. Let me start off by saying, what's the American Security Project doing about any of this? And we've been on this topic since 2005 hard. In 2009, we put out a climate security index. In 2012, a climate security report. You can get all these online on our website. In 2013, our most recent product, we put out a global security and defense index on climate change. And what that did was we went to every country in the world and asked their defense establishment if they had written climate change into their national security strategy. Interesting figure, 70% of the 190, give or take, countries, 70% had written that into their national security strategy. The 30% then didn't were mostly third world countries without much of a military strategy to speak of. So this is indeed a worldwide problem. I spent 13 years of my Marine career either in California or Japan. To me, to quote another admiral, Admiral Lockheed Lear, who's the Pacific Command commander, climate change is the one threat that could destabilize the entire region. So I'm going to give you two quick poignant examples. I can give you many more. One that's not Pacific that John didn't mention, though, that some haven't tied to climate change, but that we know it caused instability with the Tuaregs in Mali. You may remember the Mali insurrection last year. In 2010, they had huge wildfires in Eastern Europe, or Western Europe, and Soviet Union, or Russia, I'm sorry. And what happened there was it burned the wheat crop, and as a consequence, the price of wheat skyrocketed. Well, the Tuaregs were in South Mali trying to grow crops. Huge drought there, so they had to move. Simultaneous with that, the price of wheat just exponentially went up in the Middle East. So it was a huge contributor to the Arab Spring, and then the drought in South Mali caused the Tuaregs to go north because they couldn't grow crops in the south, and then that's what caused their problem in northern Mali. So there is a direct connection there in terms of climate change and instability. And the other one I'll mention, and John briefly touched about Bangladesh. I work with a Army Major General from Bangladesh quite a bit named Muni Razaman, wonderful guy. They've got, Bangladesh has 150 million people in the country, but 5.5 million live within the floodplain in Bangladesh. They know that if the water goes up 1.5 feet, which I will guarantee you it's going to in the next 30 years, they got to move 5.5 million people. The problem is the border that they have with India, which is an armed border very similar to what we had. It used to be between East and West Berlin. The Indians don't want anything to do with the Bangladeshis. They know they have a huge problem, and this is brought on by climate change. And lastly, and I can talk a little bit about California. You all are, I'm sure, intimate with the drought business here. 90% of California is in severe drought or worse. 65% is in extreme drought or worse. 2013 here in San Francisco broke the century-old record for lack of precipitation. You had 5.59 inches last year. Maybe you're going to fix a little bit of that this weekend, or you hope at least. The previous low was 9 inches in 1917. Your average here is 23.65. And where it's really hitting you all here is in the farming and agriculture community, although you're certainly seeing it here when you're trying to water your lawn. 600,000 acres of farmland in Central Valley are going to go devoid of crops due to lack of water. It will cost $11 billion in lost annual state revenue in California agriculture in 2014. That's our prediction. It's going to get worse. It's just going to get worse. You know, and it's not like no one was going to predict this in the past. Here at the American Security Project, we put out a project in 2011 called Pay Now, Pay Later, where we went state by state to show you what the economic impact of climate change was going to be. And in 2011, we said California's agriculture energy industry, which employs over 1 million workers and is worth $30 billion, is expected to suffer heavy losses due to rising temperatures and water shortages due to climate change. We said that in 2011, and what you are seeing now are the results of that. So let me close by saying we're here from the American Security Project to take it from a military, nonpartisan perspective to say it is a threat, it's a big threat. You might say, okay, what are you going to do about it now? Clearly, you've got to reduce CO2 emissions, and there's hundreds of ways of doing it, and there has been some progress. If you're familiar with CAFE standards, corporate adjusted fuel economy standards, which were raised last year, are going to go to 54 miles per gallon per car. You know, there were naysayers that said, one, you could never pass, and secondly, you'll never get support of the auto industry. The entire auto industry in this country supported those standards. And you might say, oh, that's wonderful. They really, you know, are they really for helping things that are going to limit climate change? Not really. They want to sell cars. And they figured out that if they could sell, if everybody realizes that you can get a car that goes 54 miles per gallon instead of one at 20, and the cost of gas is $3.50 a gallon, they're going to buy your new car. So, I mean, I don't need to denigrate them necessarily, but there are ways we can work on curbing CO2 emissions that are going to help. Whether it's a cap and trade, we at the American Security Project are kind of an all-the-above organization. We support all of those efforts. We are certainly strongly in favor of alternative energies. Now, whether that's renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, tidal, we're all for that. We're for even looking farther down the line, and I know we have a representative here from Lawrence Livermore. We are huge fusion proponents. We think fusion is a possible solution to some of our energy problems, and we have helped get funding restored for that this year in Congress. So there are a number of ways to keep this going and fan that flame, and we intend and certainly on doing that. So with that, let me say thank you, everybody, for being here. I realize I'm preaching a little bit to the choir, I think, but maybe not. We might have some people who don't believe anything I said. So I'm willing to take all comers and take questions or do a Q&A. We've got about 15 minutes here, so hopefully if you've got a question, just stick your hand in the air, stand up, tell me who you are, and belt it out, and maybe we can get a little bit of a dialogue going. So with that, I'll conclude my comments. Thank you very much. Any hot questions, or have I bored you to tears? We still have more food. We got more. Yes, sir.
Can we stand up?
Oh, well, you can sit down. Just right. You kind of belt it out. Tell me who you are. And
yeah, so my name is Tim O'Connor. I work for Environmental Defense Fund, a nonprofit here in the city, but also in California and the rest of the U.S. The presentation talked about microgrids on the bases, and that obviously has a real opportunity to be demonstration projects for the rest of the U.S. and for other municipal governments and cities. To what extent are like the base commanders invested in the idea that they should be reducing their energy use in pursuing innovative ideas like demand response, energy efficiency, you know, changing the time of use of their energy so that they can like meet these 2020 goals? Or is it from the top down, or is it really like you have to get the individual base commanders to buy into?
Well, I'll speak for a little bit from the Marine perspective, and maybe you can handle the Army side of the house, having been a base commander at Parris Island. And this will drive you crazy. We had our own oil-fired power plant at Parris Island, which we very rarely used. We were taking energy off the grid of the local populace, but when there was a surge or a problem or went down, we fired up our own. You can imagine the pollution because it was across the street from my house. But yes, it's more. It has been more top down, but the base commanders have been told, and it's kind of the way the military is, to get with it and look at alternative sources, reduce your energy as net zero, reduce your energy production, stop wasting energy. And I can tell you, all the services I know have what's called an installation command, which gathers all the installations under one central commander, usually headquartered out of Washington, D.C., and they pass these dictums down to the individual basis. But it is a hot topic, and certainly with Secretary Hagel, and I know Secretary Mavis, who's the Secretary of the Navy, so that covers Navy, Marine Corps. It is top down, but I don't know of a single base commander that's not on his priority list to do something about it and look at other sources of energy. So, John, I'll pass this over to you and see if you want to say the same about the Army.
I'd like to address what the Army's doing, because I think, you know, there, as I mentioned, the net zero program in the Army, yeah, it's a top-down program, no doubt about it. The Army has set out directions to its installations that by 2020, there needs to be a program in place to stop the wasting of energy. And that Army installations have to, they all have to generate their own energy and be energy self-sufficient and not, again, not waste any. So it's coming from the Army staff and from the Department of the Army down to all the installations. But the installation, one of the ways they do that is they give installations incentives to accomplish these rather ambitious energy use goals. So installations that do well and show a decrease in wasted energy get more money than other installations that don't do well. So, I mean, America is an incentive-driven society, I think you'd agree. Although you might not think the military is always incentive-driven, we tell people what to do and they do it. Well, the reason they do it is because they have incentives to do it. And if you give a base an incentive like that, they're going to respond, and they are. So Fort Hood, for example, I was just at Fort Hood 3 months ago. In fact, there was what's called the Defense Energy Summit, and the commander of Fort Hood got up in front of the group and said, "We're not doing everything we need to do, but we're doing better day by day." And he was serious about that. And he's an Army three-star Army general, who is getting rated by his senior officers for how well he accomplishes his energy use goals. And in turn, he's rating the officers that work for him, the colonels and the lieutenant colonels that command battalions and brigades. So and divisions. And he's the one that's telling them, hey, you have to accomplish this goal, and if you do it well, I'm sure there's a negative incentive too, but okay, everybody knows that. But the positive incentives are the ones that matter. So if they do well, if the units do well, they get rewarded with not just that you did a good job, but they actually get more money for their programs. This is the way it works. And so they've really got this, one, not waste energy, and two, they have to be self-sufficient. So it's a really important program, certainly in the Army. The other services are, I'm sure, executing similar programs. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Great. That makes me think one thing that I did not mention earlier. The number one consumer of fossil fuels in the country, and some say the world, guess who that is? The Department of Defense. Our Department of Defense is the number one consumer of fossil fuels in the country and probably the world. And you can imagine with the jets and ships and trucks that they use that it's going to do that. Secretary Mabus from the Department of the Navy has a very aggressive program on alternative fuels, biofuels, and he's used them in his ships and planes last summer in a RIMPAC exercise in Hawaii. He's been criticized for it. The criticism is the cost per gallon was probably about $200, give or take. The science that I see and the folks that I talk to in the biofuel community tell me that that price, like any other acquisition program, the cost of research and development is loaded up front, and it's going to drop down, whereas the cost of a gallon of biofuel by 2018 or 2019, roughly, will be the same as the cost of normal gasoline you have today. So I get a lot of naysayers on the biofuel side thinking maybe Mabus was crazy to put it in his ships and planes. It's costing too much money. He understands, and by the way, it's not, I can get into the argument about growing, using corn and robbing the food stocks. They don't take kernel corn. They take the stalks, they're growing algae to do it. So there's some real advantages to biofuels, but that's a long way of answering your question.
Can I say one thing about the Navy? Biofuels is new technology, and there's a lot of work going into that, and it will get less and less expensive over time. So naysayers are saying, oh, look how much it costs. Over time, it'll get less. But one thing the Navy's doing that's not advanced technology that I think I remember learning about this a couple months ago, the Navy is reducing fuel costs by installing stern flaps on the back of ships. Now, what does that do? It smooths the transit. It means that the ship will sail or will go through the water more efficiently, reducing millions of gallons of fuel every year. So this is not a magic solution. It's just figuring out, okay, how can we make the ship go through the water more efficiently? the Navy's really got it. They're working hard on this. And so it's a really interesting program.
Question.
Yeah, so my name's Eric Oosterwald. I'm from Mother Jones. There, in 2009, the CIA started a program, or a part of the agency, called the Action on Climate Change and Security. So what you guys are talking about is not entirely unprecedented. But is there, you're talking about individual branches of the military and their efforts. Is there any coordinating part of the Pentagon, any agency that's dedicated to oversight of this sort of subject?
Oh, sure.
And is there a plan?
Yeah. It's the Office of Secretary of Defense has oversight of all the services.
Okay.
And they have an energy department that runs that. I'm trying to think of the name of this.
Sharon Burke.
And if you've not heard her speak, she's a real proponent of this stuff. She is the coordinator at the Department of Defense level.
My bigger question regarding that is, since that CIA agency was cut after like 3 years because of Congress, what are the risks of program cuts to these sort of initiatives within the military?
Yeah,
well?
For those who couldn't hear the question back, you said the CIA's program was cut.
Yeah.
And what are the threats to cuts in the current programs, I presume, out of the defense budget? I know next to nothing about the CIA. Maybe that's a good thing. I certainly don't know anything. I have no window into their budget, so I can't answer that question on the CIA's part of the house. You may be aware, it was hot news yesterday. The DoD budget for 2015 came out. There are cuts pretty much across the board, more so on the Army than anybody else, Army and Marines and personnel side of the house, some acquisition programs. Sequestration, if you've been watching the budget process as I have over the last year, and that is another topic the American Security Project covers pretty much in depth, hit our website. We had Larry Korb last week. We've had a number of people talk about it recently. There's no doubt, given the fact that we're pulling out of Afghanistan and are already out of Iraq, the defense budget has to go down. I mean, it's got to go down. And I think the latest one that Hagel's proposed is fairly reasonable. Now, in terms of specific cuts to the energy side, I've not seen any. So yesterday was all big ticket items, i.e. F-35, personnel, some retirement benefits, health care on TRICARE, that kind of thing. I didn't see energy mentioned in any of that stuff. So my supposition is that Mavis can continue along, for instance, on his biofuel program, because I'm not aware of anybody that it's been cut in Congress. But that's probably one I have to take for the record and come back to you on.
Okay.
Do a little bit more research. And, you know, of course, Hagel is the whole budget. He didn't throw out the entire budget then. He just briefed the high points of it. And then the QDR comes out, Quadrennial Defense Review, here in the next week. So I don't think anybody has all the specifics on it. And that will be one that we will follow very closely. Does that answer your question, John?
If I may, the other dynamic that's going on with the Department of Defense is that saving energy saves money. So the first answer to anybody from, let's say, Congress or any other body that's interested in the issue that says, well, your energy program, we need to cut it. Really? Why would you want to cut something that costs less money? And that's what they can say. So yes, okay, you have to consider the cost of ownership with the biofuels program over a, you know, let's call it a life cycle. Invest now so that you can save money later, much more money than you will if you don't invest now. And that's the dynamic. So the best thing that energy saving programs have going for them is that when you save energy, you save funds, and you allow funds to be distributed in places that we need to use them, like making our troops more ready or making our training better. So it's a beautiful dynamic. Saving energy saves money. And that's the big picture, but it comes down to little things too, whether it's, I'll give you another example of where there are programs in place to save energy at the very low unit level. There's advanced technology work going into making new kinds of batteries for, among other things, tactical radios or satellite transmitters. Now, you think, well, that's going to save money for the guy that has to use the tactical radio. But think about the logistics of that for just a second. If you can take 10 batteries and only use and cascade that down to one, you save all that money, all that logistics cost, huge effect throughout the enterprise. That's what the military is doing. They're saving money. So to develop energy-saving technologies is a way to save money. and that means that you can operate more effectively.
Sure. Yes, sir.
Josh Weezy, I work with the Global Call for Climate Action, big network of NGOs, and we spent a lot of time thinking about these multilateral fora working towards solutions, and so I spent a lot of time treaty talks, and we got a pretty packed agenda over the next 2 years. It's a big moment in New York. Ban Ki-moon is convening heads of state for the first time since, I think, Copenhagen, to talk about climate change. And the hope is that it'll be a catalyst for action and commitments going into this hoped for 2015 treaty. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the American Security Project's plans, both domestically, you mentioned day tours like this, what's coming up, and if you could share a little bit about how your organization, as well as maybe your peers in other countries, are feeding into this international effort.
Yeah, Josh, I mean, great question, and thanks for asking it. I'm a member of a group called the Global Military Advisory Group on Climate Change, formed out of Brussels. The intent was to get senior military, usually one or two, from every country in the world that had an interest in this, and mobilize it from the perspective that we've talked to you all today. And we've met a couple times. We do a lot of Skyping, a lot of talking, and the intent is to build up to 2015 in Paris and to mobilize the military communities in all the countries in the world. And it's turned into, you can go online and pick up the organization. It's starting to get some traction. As with anything else, the problem's funding. I'm not going to Brussels every weekend, so we'll see how that works out. We have a contractual relationship now with the European Union. And one of the kind of deep down feelings of the EU folks is that they don't think we get it here in the United States, that we're just not picking up where we should in terms of climate change and doing something about it, CO2 in particular. And so they have worked with us. They're helping us sponsor events here in the United States to get that message out. And you've pretty much heard sort of my pitch that I give, that I gave up in Pittsburgh, is funding partially by them. So we meet with them. I'm meeting them, matter of fact, when I get back on Thursday. So on the international side, there's a lot of work. We're meeting with the UNFCCC today, as a matter of fact. I was supposed to be there, but I was here. So the UN has come to us on ASP now and asked us to give that perspective, because we're not like a lot of the organizations that are purely nonprofits. Our focus is pretty much the national security side of it, and we are using that niche. And it's because Kerry and Hagel said, maybe you can convince the far right, i.e. maybe Tea Partiers, that there is a security part of this, and it's not just a Greenpeace tree hug, you know, left-wing liberal that you know, wants to save the polar bears. And my senior fellow for energy will talk about polar bears. He goes, it's not about polar bears.
But I really like
them. Yeah, I know you like polar bears. It's not. It's a much bigger issue. It's a national security issue, and that's where we come from. So it's unique from ASP. We are a small organization. I tell people all the time, we are not the American Enterprise Institute or the Council on Foreign Relations, of which I'm a member, Brookings, Heritage. We're not any of those. They are all mostly funded, in some cases, by the political right, in the case of AEI and Heritage, or the left, in the case of CNAS and Truman. We come down in the middle. You know, we'll swing both ways, if you will, which is a tough spot to be in, because you upset equal sides. And I constantly get asked, what's your position on Keystone Pipeline? We don't have one. My personal opinion is there are probably more pros than cons. My senior fellow for energy hates it. So we got a division on our own staff. We've not come up formally, and there is no ASP position on Keystone Pipeline. So if you're writing that down, that's mine and not ASP's. But personally, I think burning the CO2 is a bad thing. So we go from there. Does that answer your question in terms of the United States? We've got, I think, 8 or 9 more cities to go. I didn't mention all of them. We're going to El Paso, for instance. We're going to Orlando. These are different places with different communities we think that are impacted by climate change. Texas, of course, I touched on that a little bit. It's got a problem. Florida, big problem. We're going to Colorado, big problem. and it's just not your normal folks. We're trying to approach the right a little more than the left, if you will, to pitch the argument. So two-year project.
Quick clarification. So the Global Military Advisory Network, you think, is the main forum where these conversations are happening in a maybe a public-facing way?
You mean for ASP?
For international stuff.
No, I think we're doing a lot more. We do more work with the EU and the UN than we do with GMAC. I call it GMAC. I mean, I work with those guys quite a bit, but it's not our big program. The bigger one is with the European Union.
Okay.
and the UN.
Thanks.
Yeah. Anybody else? Well, again, I'm so tickled to see everybody here, and on very short notice. I'm sorry for that, but it was kind of a pop-up. I had a dinner I was attending here tonight anyway, and we said, hey, this is an opportunity, and General Adams flew in here from Florida specifically for this event. So I encourage you to hit our website, americansecurityproject.org. If you need anybody to come talk to it from the perspective we come from, let us know. I have a senior fellow named Andrew Holland. He would have been here, but he's at the UN. Please keep up with it, and again, I appreciate you being here. Thank you very much.